Accepting responsibility. And I'm going to begin with a couple of historical illustrations to illustrate my point. I like history, so I hope you don't mind me starting off with a couple of historical illustrations, and then we'll get into some biblical illustrations of accepting responsibility. There's a battlefield, a Civil War battlefield not far from here, maybe the most famous Civil War battlefield, not too far from here over in Pennsylvania, Gettysburg. And perhaps the climax of those three days or so of battles that occurred between Union and Confederate forces was a charge on the part of Confederate soldiers, led partially by a Confederate General Pickett. So it became known as Pickett's Charge, and it was a colossal, miserable failure. And as the remnants of Confederate General Robert E. Lee's soldiers came limping back after their dismal failure to overrun the Union lines in what became known as Pickett's Charge, he went out to meet them. And he met them with these words on his lips. "It's all my fault. It is I who have lost this fight." Well, what was it? Maybe 80 years later or so, somewhere around in the 80 years later, I think it was about 1950, another general, this time General Dwight D. Eisenhower, he was about to become president, but General Dwight D. Eisenhower, about 1950, was looking for a retirement home. He had been in the Army and he never had a retirement home, and so his wife said, "You know, we need to find a home. We need to settle down someplace. Someplace we can call our own." So they were recommended a place at the edge of Gettysburg, the edge of the battlefield. And Eisenhower liked that idea because he had one of his posts had early on in his Army career had been in the Gettysburg area or close to Gettysburg, and So he liked that idea, and today, as a matter of fact, as part of the National Park System, you can go over to the edge of the Gettysburg battlefield, and you can tour the Eisenhower's retirement home there. But the reason I bring him up is because about 81 years later, General Dwight Eisenhower, in the event the assault he had ordered on the beaches of Normandy in France on June 6, 1944, or D-Day, which we just commemorated the 75th anniversary of D-Day, what, about 10 days ago, I guess it was then? Yes. Well, he had ordered this assault. He was the top guy, and it was his responsibility to say, "Go or we don't go," so he said, "Go." Well, there were some problems. I won't go into all the problems, you know. There was the weather that was something of a factor. So I'm just making the point that he knew there was the possibility that the attack might be repulsed. So in the event that the attack failed on D-Day, he prepared a statement, which he never had to use. But this is the way the statement read, at least partially. "Our landings have failed, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." It brings emotions to the fore in me to hear words like that on the part of Robert E. Lee, to hear leaders saying, "It's all my fault. If there's any blame for the failure to be attached to anyone, it attaches to me alone." I say that because it's really kind of unusual in my experience today to hear people saying things like that. I mean, how often do people say when there's a problem of some sort, when some mistake, big or small, has been made, it's my fault. It's my fault. How often do you hear people accepting full responsibility for failures or mistakes? And doing so without qualification, without any excuse at all, saying, I'm the one at fault here. As a matter of fact, something like that is so unusual that it's regarded as virtuous, even heroic, for people to utter words like that. I wish sometimes we could hear them more often. I made a mistake. It's my fault. It's my problem. I created this situation by what I did. I would feel so much better about people just to hear them acknowledge that sometimes. But really what I hear out of people's mouths is, well, you did this too. Look what you did. Or, well, I would have done it except that this and this and this happened. You hear a mouthful of excuses, if anything. People will either blame their mistakes on others or at least try to relieve themselves of some of the fault by making excuses for what they have done. Why is that? Well, I think it seems to be pretty obvious, the psychology behind it. Nothing strikes at a person's sense of his own self-worth, what we tend to call ego or who he thinks he is, than having to admit he made a mistake. Or he was at fault. We think that when we say it's my fault, that, oh, I'm less of a person. I'm less of a person. I'm not very good. Or we even might say, oh, I'm a bum. But we don't want to think of ourselves like that, do we? So when we make mistakes, we tend to make it seem, or try to make it seem like it's not really our fault or not really our mistakes. You know, not too long ago, I read a small, sad story in a book. Some of you may be old enough to remember. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. Extremely few of you would be old enough to remember George McGovern. George McGovern, back in the 60s, was a senator from South Dakota. And he had the Democratic nomination for the presidency in 1972 and lost to Richard Nixon in his second run for the presidency. But anyway, he was fairly famous politically. Well, he had a couple of children who were alcoholics. I think he and his wife had five children. Two of them were alcoholics, and ultimately the two who were alcoholics died of their alcoholism. Yeah. And one day back in, I think it was December 13th, 1994, and I was living here in New Jersey at that time. I remember reading the report or hearing the report that George McGovern's daughter was found frozen to death in the snow in Wisconsin. And she had been a long time alcoholic, and that's how her life ended. And basically he wrote a book about, he entitled it Terry. Her name was Teresa. He entitled the book Terry, My Daughter's Lifelong Struggle, or Life and Death Struggle, actually. Life and Death Struggle with Alcoholism. And since I'm bringing to you some ideas about accepting responsibility, I want to read to you just very briefly a couple of excerpts from his book about his daughter. And alcoholics in general, he says at the bottom of page 20, alcoholics have a tendency to engage in what professionals call externalizing, blaming their problems on other people, including those persons they love the most, because she was blaming her problems, you know, her psychological problems and so forth on her parents and her siblings too, I think, claiming she was mistreated or she was neglected when she was growing up and so forth and so on. And I want to read a little bit longer excerpt because McGovern says some things here that I think we need to think about. Because let's say this. let's observe this. I mean, who hasn't had family problems? Okay. Some people grow up in very, very good and stable homes, but I mean, are parents perfect? You know, I mean, parents make mistakes, you know? And so, but some people become fixated on those problems. Now, let me say this. I'm not trying to diminish the problems that some people, some children have. Some children are physically and emotionally and verbally abused terribly. I don't mean to diminish that. But then we have to ask, whatever the level of problems we think we might have experienced in our homes, or anywhere else in life for that matter, whether it's on the job or elsewhere, we have to ask ourselves, how often are we going to allow those problems, or the people who created those problems for us, how long are we going to allow that to control us? Are we still going to suffer at their hands? It's not going to change anything to continue to wallow in those things, so to speak, and allow those problems to control our lives for the rest of our lives and make our lives worse. If our lives are going to be anything, we're going to have to overcome the past and say, in effect, I'm not going to let them control me forever. Listen, let me use another example. I'm really getting off on a tangent here. I'm sorry about that. But listen, I would not be a preacher today. Last month I was preaching the gospel for 45 years. I would not be a preacher today if I allowed myself to get down about every bad thing that people have said to me about my preaching. I just finally had to get to the point where, listen, I'm going to do the best that I can. If you know, brethren don't like that, if they can't appreciate that, then, well, maybe I'll just move on, and that's what I did, somewhere where people, you know, can think it's okay. So I've been here Piscataway for about 28 years now. So, but anyway, that's you have to get to that point in life. You're going to have to say, yes, I was abused. Yes, some people mistreated me. But what I'm really doing is allowing them to continue to make a victim of me, continue to abuse me, continue to mistreat me. If I allow that to cause me, in effect, to mistreat other people. Well, anyway, let me read to you what George McGovern says here. I several times responded to her contentions of family neglect by saying, in effect, Terry, let's assume you were right about all of this. That Eleanor and I were not always as wise as we should have been as parents. We doubtless did make mistakes, as did your sisters. But this is now history. We can't change the past. What we can do, and what you can do, is to move on from those mistakes we cannot change to facing as best we can the problems and responsibilities of today. I like that. Don't like a lot of other things he did, but I like that. He was right about that, I think. But he goes on to say this, and this comes closer to my point today about our need to accept responsibility for our mistakes, our faults. He says, I think such reality challenges made her uncomfortable because she was in fact living in pain, uncertainty, and anxiety caused primarily by long years of alcoholism. Now, let me pause there for just a moment. You know, that's the problem with people. The real causes sometimes of our problems is what we have done. We've brought these things on ourselves. Okay? But we don't want to accept that. That makes us look pretty bad. We feel pretty bad about that. So what do? We take the burden off our shoulders and put it on somebody else sometimes, in order to relieve ourselves of that burden. Okay, one more sentence. McGovern goes on to say, it was indeed painful to accept responsibility for her own life, including her own past mistakes, and she had to find some deeper explanation for the alcoholism that caused it all. Okay, so I'm using that to illustrate that sometimes, you know, a lot of times we just need to face up to reality and say, you know, I caused this problem. And when we do that, we've gone a long way toward fixing the problem. All right, I'll use some historical examples. Let me use some biblical examples now. Lewis read from this passage a while ago. But you've got Adam and Eve here, okay? The first sinners. They tried to blame their sin on others. Well, here you have Adam. Adam blamed God, at least by implication, it seems, by creating Eve. He said, "The woman whom you gave to me, she gave me of the fruit, and I ate." As if to say, well, you know, Lord, if you hadn't created her and given her to me in the first place, no, I wouldn't be in this predicament today. So it's really your fault for giving her to me. And then he turns to Eve, and Eve says, well, you know, the serpent deceived me and I ate. Well, you know, that's true. The serpent did deceive her. But here's the point. As bad as Satan was, and he was really bad, she did not have to be deceived. She didn't have to be deceived. That was her fault. That was on her. I'm sorry, I didn't cite the scripture. I put it up on the screen. Let me move to the next one now. Simeon and Levi. Okay, you had a man by the name, young man by the name of Shechem in Genesis, the 34th chapter, who lay sexually with their sister. And ultimately, they tried to work out this problem by, you know, intermarriage with Shechem's city. And, well, even after, as part of the agreement, the men of Shechem circumcised themselves and were in pain and so forth, Simeon and Levi went up and slaughtered them all while they were incapacitated and took their cattle and, you know, and everything. Simeon and Levi, you know, they overreacted here. And what was their excuse? When their father confronted them and said, "You have made us odious before everyone." Well, their response, well, should he have treated our sister like a harlot? So because of what one man did, they felt like they were justified in slaughtering a whole city of people or men. That's an excuse. They're not really accepting responsibility there. They're trying to pass the blame to what one man, Shechem, did to their sister. Then there's the example of Aaron. You know, the people came to him and said, you know, we don't know what has happened to Moses. So, you know, he said, well, give me your jewelry, your gold, and so forth. And he made this golden calf at Mount Sinai. You probably remember that story. Well, I mean, he really makes some doozies of some excuses here. Let's go. It's really laughable what he says. Here in Exodus, the 32nd chapter, verse 22, when he's confronted by Moses, Moses says in verse 21, "What did this people do to you that you have brought such great sin upon them?" And Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord burn. You know the people yourself that they are prone to evil." So what's he doing? He's passing it off to the people. Well, Aaron was the high priest. He was the leader in Moses' absence. It was his responsibility to see that they did the right thing. You're not much of a leader if you allow the other people to lead you around and do the wrong thing. That's just the opposite of what a leader ought to do. But it gets worse. He says in verse 24, "And I said to them, whoever has any gold, let them tear it off. So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf." Well, let's leave aside the fact that he's lying. It really didn't happen that way. But when he says, "I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf," who's he really passing the blame to there? I mean, that's a miracle. Out came this calf through golden fire. Out came a calf. That's a miracle. God did it. God gave us this calf. So he's not accepting responsibility. He's passing it off. I think this is the last example. King Saul, he was commanded to go and destroy all of the Amalekites, all of them and their livestock, not spare anything. In 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, after his disobedience, he is confronted by Samuel. And he tries to excuse himself. He comes up with a number of excuses here. First of all, in verse 15, he says, "They have brought them," that is the cattle, "from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but the rest we have utterly destroyed." So he says, the people have done it. These others have done it. And he mentions them several times. The first excuse he makes was that the people have done it. His second excuse was to claim that, believe it or not, he had actually obeyed. Okay? It's something. You confront some people with their disobedience and they say, "I did obey. You didn't do this like you were told." Yes, I did. It's amazing. But that's what he said. In verse 20 it says, "Then Saul said to Samuel, 'I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission on which the Lord sent me and have brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites.'" I did obey the voice of the Lord. And then really contradicts himself by saying, "I brought back Agag, the king." He was supposed to have been killed. So he's in denial. just not observing reality here. His third excuse was to claim that his disobedience was really good. It's a good thing. Good thing. Well, how do you figure that? Well, he says in verse 21, "But the people took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the choicest of the things devoted to destruction to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal." Again, he's bringing up this idea. We're going to sacrifice these animals that we're supposed to have killed to God. And that's what brings on the famous statement of Samuel in verse 22. "Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord?" So these are just some biblical examples of the really silly excuses people will make for not doing what they were told. Instead of accepting responsibility for their mistakes. Well, what does it mean to accept responsibility? I want to give you four answers to that question. And the first of these four answers is that it means to feel sorrow and regret for our mistakes. In 2 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, verses 8 through 10, Paul mentions the value of feeling sorrow and regret for our mistakes because it impels us to make corrections. It's important to feel bad about what we've done wrong. If we don't feel bad about that, then are we going to correct it? So in 2 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, verses 8 through 10, Paul says, "For though I caused you sorrow by my letter, I do not regret it. Though I did regret it, for I see that that letter caused you sorrow, though only for a while. I now rejoice, not that you were made sorrowful, but that you were made sorrowful to the point of repentance. For you were made sorrowful according to the will of God, in order that you might not suffer loss in anything through us. For the sorrow that is according to the will of God produces a repentance without regret, leading to salvation. But the sorrow of the world produces death." Okay, just being sorry per se is not such a good thing. Now, when the regret moves us to make some changes, that's what we're really looking for. The end result of proper sorrow. And yet some are so steeped in their sins that they find it hard to make real confessions. But one who feels responsibility for wrongdoing cannot avoid feeling guilt and regret. Acceptance of responsibility has got to be genuine in order for it to do any good. We some people will confess, but maybe just to be relieved of punishment, maybe by eliciting sympathy from the one who would otherwise punish them. But they have got to be, genuine. They've got to flow from the conviction that we've done wrong and that it is our fault, and as a result of that, we're sorry. We regret that. But not only feelings, but there has got to be a verbal acknowledgement of our mistakes. You know, have you ever gone to someone who maybe mistreated, maybe you made some claim that turned out not to be true, and you had to go to them? You don't like it, but you have to go to them, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing. And say, "I'm sorry, you said this, I said that. Well, I was wrong, you were right." Yeah, it's a healthy thing to be able to do that. It's very unhealthy when we can't bring ourselves to do that. We have got to be able to verbalize our acknowledgement of our wrongdoings. True confession means acknowledging then to and within ourselves that we're responsible for our wrongdoing. We must accept that acknowledgement, first of all, within ourselves. You know, it's interesting. One of the heroes of a story like this, and he's an unlikely hero, but is the one who is typically known as the prodigal son in Luke, the 15th chapter. He's a hero in this lesson. Why? But because, listen to the way he puts it in verse 17. "But when he came to his senses," now it says when he came to his senses, came to himself. He's talking to himself. As far as we know, there was nobody around. So he doesn't have to make any excuses to anybody else. There's nobody around apparently. He's talking to himself here. He acknowledges this within himself. What's he got to do? He says, "How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I am dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father and will say to him," and here's the acknowledgement, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men." He's not holding anything back, is he? Not holding anything back. Not putting the blame on his father, anything. He acknowledges what he has done wrong. And you know, the greatest confessions that you read about in the Scriptures, and I give you some here from Psalm 51, David there, he just comes right out and says, and without making any excuses, "I've done wrong. I've done wrong. It's my fault." It is a tragedy for a person to be unwilling to accept responsibility for his mistakes, because if we don't accept responsibility for our mistakes, we cannot correct them. We can't do anything about it. We're living in unreality, really. If a person refuses to accept responsibility for his mistakes, you know who's getting hurt the worst there? It's the person himself. He's getting hurt the worst. He hurts himself more than anyone else by the self-deception of thinking that if it had not been for others, then he would have done what's right instead of what was wrong. So he deceives himself into thinking that, oh, he was really powerless to do other than what he had done. Well, as long as he continues to deny the reality that he is responsible for his actions, then he cannot correct what has caused him to do wrong in the first place. I don't know if you want to call him an unlikely hero or not, but there's really something honorable in the life of Judah, one of Jacob's 12 sons, as it's recorded in the 38th chapter of Genesis. It's really a sordid story. But Judah refused to give the widow of his first two sons to his third son. Now, I know that sounds weird, but that's the way they did things back then. You could have hand-me-down wives back then. I know it doesn't sound good, but that's the way that was their practice back then. Well, he was basically saying, to put it in terms some people today would put, this woman's bad luck. I'm not going to give my third son to her because he might die too. So he refused to do that. And well, not justifying her by any means, but what she did was to go out and dress up as a harlot, which apparently meant covering her face too, and sat by the road that she apparently knew Judah was going to come down. And Judah, and this is pretty callous here, he thinks she's a prostitute, and he goes in and has relations with her. And as a result, without him knowing it, that sounds really weird too, doesn't it? I mean, he wouldn't have her identity. But that, again, that's the way they did things back then. She gets pregnant by him. And, okay, of course, about 3 months later, it's reported to Judah, your daughter-in-law is with child by harlotry. Well, she had gotten some of his personal belongings when they had had this sexual liaison. Now, he doesn't know all of this. He doesn't know all of this. But let's just start reading with verse 24 here. Just read a few verses. Now it came about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Of course, we would recognize that today as big time hypocrisy. Okay. The woman has to pay, but the man does not. Okay. Notice in verse 25, though, it was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Now here's where Judah finally does something right. Verse 26 says, and Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. But those words, he fully acknowledged the truth here. She is more righteous than I. Now this was a very embarrassing situation for Judah, I would imagine. Did he try to make some sort of excuses? Did he say, well, she must have stolen these things, anything like that? No. He just came right out and said, she's more righteous than I. He accepted responsibility. You know, it's been said that confession is good for the soul. A guilty person confesses for his own good. Some people may think, I can't confess. Because if I confess to wrongdoing, then this person will feel like he's been vindicated by my confession. Well, you know, that's his problem. You know, really, for your own good, you need to recognize that you need to confess your wrongdoing. But as long as a person does not confess he did wrong, then he's liable to do it again. A third point then. When we talk about or answer the question, what does it mean to accept responsibility? It means accepting the adverse consequences or penalty of one's mistakes. Now, when we make mistakes, sooner or later, oftentimes, there are going to be some adverse consequences. We may fool ourselves, deceive ourselves into thinking that, you know, we can make this mistake and we're not going to pay the price for it. The price may come years, maybe even decades later, especially if it's something that has become a pattern in our lives. We have to be willing to accept the adverse consequences or even the penalty for our mistakes. And sometimes this includes making restitution where we can. We can't always restore things. We can't always make restitution. But where we can do that, we should. If we've stolen something, for instance, just to use a classical example, if we've stolen something, we need to return it if we can, or the equivalent in money or whatever. The law of Moses required restitution. I don't know that we'll look at all of these passages, but for instance, let's look at Exodus 22, verse 1, where it says, "If a man steals an ox or sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the sheep, ox, and 4 sheep for the sheep." In other words, you have to do something to make restitution. I tell you what, I won't read these other passages because they essentially say the same thing as Exodus 22 verse 1 does. Make restitution where you can. Here's a hero that is basically kind of untarnished in the scriptures. Judah didn't make such a good hero, but he did something right there. But Lazarus, not the brother of Mary and Martha, but the publican or the tax gatherer. In Luke, the 18th chapter, when he met up with Jesus, listen to what he said to Jesus. He says, "I tell you," you know something? That is the wrong passage. It's not chapter 18, verse 8. I think it's chapter 19. Yes, it's one chapter over. Luke 19, verse 8. And Zacchaeus, I really made a mistake there. It's Zacchaeus. So two mistakes. I accept responsibility for that. It's not Jerry's fault in this case. Usually it's his fault. But where did I get Zacchaeus? Somewhere I got Lazarus in my mind. But it's Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is the guy's name. Okay. And it's Luke 19. Let me check my notes to see if I can blame that on Jerry here. Now, I've got Luke 18. Should be Luke 19. Luke 19, verse 8, and it's Zacchaeus. Okay. And Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, half of my possessions I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will give back 4 times as much." Now, if he had been a particularly bad man and he had gotten all of his wealth through fraud, defrauding people, what he's basically saying here is, listen, I value my salvation so much, I value being right so much, that I'm willing to make myself poor. I'm going to impoverish myself if that's what it takes. So, yes, he is something of a hero. Now, Achan here, that's pretty bad. He made confession in Joshua, the 9th chapter, to taking some things from the city of Jericho that he should not have taken. And Joshua urged him to make confession. He made a full confession, knowing what might happen to him. And it actually did happen to him. He was put to death. Now, you might say, see, it didn't do Achan any good. Didn't do Achan any good to make confession there. What makes you think that? His soul today might be in paradise. Ever since then, his soul might be apparent. I can't say what actually happened to him in the afterlife, but I think it seems to me that he would have been saved because he made complete confession of his wrongdoing. He repented, it seems to me, and made confession. So I think we have good reason to believe his soul was saved. So how can you say then he shouldn't have made confession because he was put to death? If it saved his soul, he did the right thing there, even from that standpoint. So it's possible that confessors, those who confess wrongdoing, might suffer in this life. But if they save their souls, it doesn't matter if they've lost this life. Jesus said, he who loses his life will find it. He'll find salvation in the next life. Finally, what does it mean to accept responsibility? It means to resolve thereafter to do what is right. There's some people who will say, I was wrong, and then just go on and continue doing that wrong thing. So So this is what is involved in repentance. Sinners cannot change the past, but in effect, they can change the future. They can make the future better than the past was. Some acknowledge responsibility for mistakes, but they just continue on, as I said, or even worsen them in some instances. I don't know of a man who made any more confessions than King Saul. And he kept saying, "I have sinned." It seems like those were some of the favorite words on his lips. "I have sinned." When he would chase David and try to kill him, and David would try and show him, "I'm innocent," as he did on a couple of occasions, Saul would just, he would get all upset about what he had tried to do to David, maybe even weeping. And he would say, "I have sinned, I have done wrong." And then a little time would pass, it seems, and then he would go back to chasing David and trying to kill him again. So here's a man who kept confessing, but ultimately he didn't change. He just kept doing it. You know, it's easy to mouth words, "I have sinned," but that shouldn't mean, you know, I'm going to quit the sin. There is Judas as another example. He said, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." He had betrayed Jesus to his enemies. But then what did he do? Did he go out and try to live a better life? He could have done that. If he had sought forgiveness, I'm confident the Lord would have forgiven him. But instead, he tried to fix the problem by going out and hanging himself. That's not acting responsibly. So you've got to resolve thereafter to do what is right. In conclusion then, since God has given free will to each person, what he or she does with his or her life is that person's responsibility. Why? You have the choice. You don't have to do this. You're the one who chooses. No one has to sin. And thus, regardless of what others do to influence us, to hurt us, to mistreat us, to abuse us, to make victims of us, to deceive us, we're responsible for what we do. Since we can do or could have done otherwise than the wrong perhaps that we did. It all comes back to us. Why? Because we have free will. People can mistreat us, but we can choose not to allow their mistreatment to control our lives and cause us to be bad people. So no one can do any better for himself after sinning than to accept responsibility. That's the best thing you can do. When you've sinned, it's the best thing to do is accept responsibility for that sin. It's not going to help you as much. You may be deceived, or you may deceive yourself into thinking it will, but it will not help you as much to try to pass the blame off to someone else. That's just going to make matters worse. We need to accept responsibility for what we have done wrong. It may be that there is someone here today who, having recognized that maybe heretofore I haven't been accepting responsibility for my life as I should have, and I want to do that beginning today. Accepting full responsibility for my life, you know, for my wrongdoings. You know, other people, let other people, don't point your finger at other people, let other people deal with their problems. That's their problem. They need to accept responsibility. They abused you, then they need to accept responsibility for that. You can't do anything about them. All you can do is something about yourself. And if you've done wrong, accept responsibility for that. Come forward in faith and in repentance to confess before us that you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and be immersed into Him in a body of water which we prepared for that purpose. If you have done that in the past, but since then have maybe gotten into the practice of not accepting responsibility for things you've done wrong since you were baptized into Christ, and you want to put things right and accept our help and God's help, we bid you to come forward. Let that be known, as together, for your encouragement, we now stand and sing.